From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, November the 18th, 2019. And welcome to the Dave Graham Show for this Monday morning here on WDEV. Really appreciate all you folks tuning in out there, finding us online at WDEVradio.com. And it is a pleasure to be hosting this show. And wanted to mention what we got coming up today. We have three, I think, interesting segments with different guests. Colin Mine has become a Monday morning regular here on the Dave Graham Show. He's the managing editor of vtdigger.org, and he's going to be joining me just in a moment after I introduce or let you know, give you a preview of what's coming up on the rest of the show. The second segment today is going to be with Kevin Ellis. He is actually a member of the VT Digger board, but that's not why he's coming in today. He's going to be talking to us about developments in Washington related to the impeachment hearings and so on. He's been watching this stuff closely. He's a political blogger with a lot of interesting insights and ideas that he puts up online these days. And, of course, he's a former reporter for the Burlington Free Press. Then he's a longtime lobbyist and sort of political player in Washington. Leans Democratic, I will say. I think people ought to know that up front. But Kevin is a very thoughtful guy. Last time he was on, he was actually saying some interesting stuff, sort of defending the Republican Party. So we'll be getting a little couple words with Kevin this morning. Around the turn of the clock, after 10 o'clock this morning, we're going to have a very special guest, former host of this show, Mike Smith, was sitting in this very chair where I am for two or three years, I think, or something like that, on here on WDEV on this 9 to 11 a.m. slot. And these days he's back to wearing, you almost want to say a new hat, but it's really an old hat, because he served as Secretary of Human Services back during the Douglas administration for a while, interspersed with time as the administration secretary, the sort of top day-to-day operator, operations chief in state government. And Mike is going to be my guest, as I mentioned, after 10 o'clock. He's going to talk about his new tour as Secretary of Human Services. Governor Phil Scott just appointed him last month, and he's taken a few weeks, looked around, and we're going to get a report from him on the state of that agency, I think, and what he has in mind for any changes or improvements and that sort of thing. So we'll be hearing from Mike about that. But I wanted to start first this morning with Colin Mine, our good friend and Monday morning regular, as I mentioned. Good morning, Colin.
Morning, Dave.
And a lot of interesting stories in VT Digger. Boy, it seems like a sort of an exceptionally strong edition this morning of a online publication that is frequently quite strong. But you've got really interesting stuff this morning. One is a story by Kevin O'Connor about the Catholic Church, and they've been stashing money away trying to protect it from lawsuits. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so, you know, there was this recent report on priest abuse that the Catholic Church actually sort of mobilized a lay committee to look at their papers and sort of identify priests who had been credibly accused of abuse. And there was some concern or sort of expectation that this would bring new lawsuits, which originally in sort of late 90s when the Boston Globe did its spotlight investigation and this sort of became a national thing. There was a number of lawsuits that cost the Catholic Church millions and millions of dollars, and then again in the mid-2000s, and some of this new scrutiny bringing new lawsuits, and therefore is likely to cost the church new money. And the church sort of has talked about some concern that it's going to sort of run out of money and that there's just not enough there in the coffers, that they have about $16 million on the books. But Kevin's been reporting on this quite some time and recalled that back in the mid-2000s, there was some conversation of trying to move church assets, mainly property around the state, into these sort of private trusts that would be shielded from potential lawsuits down the road. So he dug into that and found out that indeed it had happened, and that the church had sent out letters to about 140 towns around the state, changing the sort of church deeds into private trusts that would be protected from lawsuits, or they hope will be protected from lawsuits, and that there's almost $500 million that are sort of $500 million worth of property assets mainly that are currently in these trusts. And this sort of raises a question as to whether or not it would be recoverable from victims if there were lawsuits and the Catholic Church had to pay. But that's likely a legal question for down the road.
Yeah, boy. Now, a couple questions I have about this. One is there anything that looks nefarious here? I mean, a lot of folks do things with their money, put money in trust and so on, basically to try to protect it. I mean, I know seniors who are trying to maximize what they're going to leave to their heirs, and they will put money in trust, for instance, to try to limit the amount they're going to have to spend down if they go to a nursing home, just for one example of people, you know, trying to protect their assets. Is there any allegation that any of this is unethical or illegal or any of that sort of thing?
Yeah, so Jerome O'Neill, who's sort of been the Burlington lawyer that's really been the lead sort of advocate for victims in the legal process for 20 years now, in the mid-2000s, he accused the Catholic Church of, and I believe even filed a lawsuit accusing it of violating Vermont's fraudulent deeds law, which basically is transferring money with the intent to avoid a right, debt, or duty. So indeed, there is a claim that this is not on the up and up. It's not unique among a number of Catholic churches around the country did similar types of things, moving millions and millions of dollars into things like graveyard trusts and sort of places where it might be shielded from general sort of lawsuits against the Catholic Church. But, you know, it hasn't really been tested in Vermont's courts because the Catholic Church still had enough money in its sort of main coffers, its unprotected coffers, to pay off victims so far, which is why this new scrutiny and these new lawsuits might sort of raise a new legal fight in what's now been a two-decade sort of dispute between victims and the Catholic Church.
Of course, they did end up selling a significant piece of property on the waterfront in Burlington. Was that a decision that they made to say, you know, this is what we're going to sacrifice, and then we're going to try to limit it from here? Or was that something that sort of fell through the cracks of what they hoped would be complete protection? Or do you have any idea?
No, like you said, I mean, I think that they sort of chose that, you know, they were going to try to protect these properties around the state, but that they had to free up some money, and that was the biggest chunk of change that they could produce in short order, obviously, that prime piece of real estate in Burlington. So, you know, that piece of land has its own story, which is referenced briefly in the story leading to, you know, Jane Sanders and Burlington College sort of collapsing.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it seemed like that was sort of part of the plan, is that they identified here's a way that we can free up some money, and then with all these other properties, let's protect them for the future.
Interesting stuff. And so the next step of this, I mean, will there be court hearings on this case that Jerome O'Neill is bringing regarding this, what did you call it, improper deeds or something?
Yeah, so that he actually, because all of the cases in the mid-2000s were settled eventually, I believe he withdrew that lawsuit, or rather the statute of limitations on the particular claim ran out. But with there's five lawsuits currently in the works, Jerome O'Neill representing victims, and potentially they have about $60 million. If those lawsuits were to lead to settlements above that, or if more were to come forward, then I think you would see renewed questions and perhaps renewed lawsuits against the church on whether or not this $500 million is really protected or not.
Well, it's going to merit continued vigilance and so on by outfits like BT Digger. I shouldn't say outfits like, because you guys are pretty unique. Maybe just by BT Digger. I don't know who else is really watching this very as carefully and thoroughly as you folks are these days, but it definitely merits continued scrutiny, shall we say. Hey, I wanted to shift gears here and ask you about another big important story that you have this morning. It involves, and correct my pronunciation if you have a better one, I'm going to guess, Aita Gurung. He's an Asian man, Asian by birth, who was living in Burlington and committed a heinous, violent act a few years ago, has been going through the court system, latest ruling is that he is mentally ill to the extent that he is not competent to stand trial. Seems to be something of a vindication for the state's attorney, so fill in the gaps here, Colin. What's going on with Mr. Gurung?
Yeah, so there was a big dispute, you know, previously over whether he was insane at the time of this very bloody and grisly murder, and the state's attorney in Chittenden County decided that basically the experts who had been hired to assess his mental state at the time of the murder said that he was insane, so she basically decided that she couldn't challenge that in court, or would be unsuccessful in challenging that in court, so she dropped the murder dismissed the murder charges. The governor, Governor Phil Scott, of course, asked Attorney General T.J. Donovan to review the case, along with two others that were fairly similar, sort of very violent attacks that had been dismissed because of the insanity defense. And Attorney General T.J. Donovan decided to bring his own charges against Ida Garung. And there was some dispute over where he'd be held in the interim. He was moved to, whether he's sort of kept in a medical facility. He's currently in a prison. So the question now is whether or not he's fit to stand trial or competent to stand trial, and a doctor has decided that he's not, that in his opinion, his current mental state is such that he wouldn't understand the charges being filed against him or the process playing out in court before his eyes. And Attorney General T.J. Donovan, through one of his assistant attorney generals, says that they are going to contest that determination and that they believe that he should still stand trial. And we'll see what sort of arguments they make against the sort of medical decision. It sounds like they're going to say something like, you know, he has been deemed competent to stand trial up until these last few weeks. So, you know, why have things suddenly changed and that kind of thing? But it seems that the attorney general is absolutely determined to make this trial happen.
Interesting stuff. I mean, I just got a text from a friend of the program. Vince Luzzi is a lawyer up in the Northeast Kingdom, state's attorney actually in Essex County, and has been around the Vermont legal system for a long time. He says, it's a text message, not an email, but he says that competency is a fluid state and can change incompetency as is at the time of the offense. And so that's an interesting point, actually, because it seems as though there are different stages when you can ask this question: is this person mentally competent enough to stand trial? I guess you would want to have a defendant in court who's up on a charge of murder being able to understand and participate to the extent defendants usually do in that process. But then the other question goes to responsibility for the crime itself. This was a heinous offense. I mean, this was a meat cleaver murder of, was it his mother-in-law, I believe? And then he attacked his wife as well.
That's right.
The mother-in-law died, as I recall. And so this is, you know, a particularly gruesome situation. There's a lot of political pressure here. First, sort out the stages of when you ask the question, is this person competent?
I think the decision has to be made. I don't really know. I don't know the specific answer to that question, to be honest.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, and Vince Luzzi here says competency is a fluid state and can change. That's a really interesting point, too, because obviously mental illness is not a static thing. So people, you know, improve and then deteriorate or whatever. I'm not sure exactly what the proper language here is, but, mental illness can wax and wane to some extent. And somebody could be more lucid at one time than another, I guess I mean. And so you could have a situation where maybe this man was in a state of severe, you know, having a particular flare up of his mental health problem at the time of the crime, at the time of the murder, and then he improves for a while he's going through various discussions with lawyers and maybe with psychiatrists to determine his competency, and then comes time of trial, and maybe the stress of actually having to go to court and face his accusers, etc., exacerbates his mental illness again. So I this whole situation is so fluid. It's really, partly tragic, partly fascinating, partly disturbing that we have such a hard time figuring this out.
Yeah, and his lawyers and the sort of mental health and physicians working with him have said basically what you said, which is that, you know, he was getting better over time as sort of, you know, the rehabilitation played out. But then, you know, he was sort of moved to a prison, which certainly didn't help from a sort of more medically focused type of institution. And then also obviously having this question over whether he would end up back on trial and that sort of thing surely has shaken him up as well. So, you know, it's hard to imagine how, you know, this latest assessment was done in early October. So how, you know, as long as this trial is sort of hanging over him, whether or not one could really get back into a, you know, better headspace if indeed they're fighting these mental health issues. But I do believe they'll continue conducting these sort of examinations.
A little additional text here from Vince Luzzi. He says, a person can become competent, which is, I think, what we were just discussing here. He says, in some of the southern states years ago on death row, they would medicate defendants and make them competent so that they could then execute them. And then he goes on to say, what stops a case in its tracks is whether the person was insane at the time of the offense. And so, again, it strikes me as a tough thing to measure, especially sort of post facto. You know, the person commits a horrible crime on, let's say, a Wednesday and at a certain date, and then it could be months later, actually, that they're getting they're having a meeting with a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist's job is to determine their mental state on that Wednesday. You know, it's just, wow, what a difficult part of the law and of the criminal justice system. And I don't envy anybody who's doing this work, because it's just got to be really, really hard. And frequently there's an awful lot of pressure, a lot of political pressure, a lot of public concern and a desire for someone to be punished. I mean, I'm sure if you read the online comments that are going to result from the latest news here, there's going to be a lot of people just saying lock him up and throw away the key kind of stuff. So that is... and one more, Vince says, the question of sanity looks to the time of the offense. Competency looks to real time now. So I guess there's a distinction here between sanity and competency. So anyway, I want to ask you about Peter Walsh, because he has been an interesting player in the impeachment proceeding so far down in Washington. He came out with one very funny moment the other day. And so give us a little review here.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that his sort of quip with two diplomats in the hot seats on Wednesday last week probably ended up being one of the most memorable moments from the hours and hours of hearings that happened, if not the most important, when he, one of his Republican colleagues said that they wanted the whistleblower in the case, and he called him the person who started it all. To come and testify, and Peter Welch said that he too wanted the person who started it all to come and testify, and proceeded to invite President Donald Trump to come before the lawmakers, and the room erupted in laughter. So that was rather memorable. But, you know, he really has become a rather sort of central figure in all this, perhaps not central, but, you know, very much involved in all of these private and public hearings. He also is very much accessible to the media in Vermont, making him quite, you know, allowing us to sort of see through his eyes what's going on with this whole process and sort of the expectations and developments day to day. So it's been really interesting. And, you know, this week there's Gordon Sondland, who, of course, is the EU ambassador, who apparently had a number of conversations with the president where they specifically discussed tying the military aid to Ukraine with an investigation into the Bidens. So that'll be really interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, this week I think is going to be perhaps no less interesting than last week, maybe more so, because with Sondland coming in, I think he may end up providing some really key testimony and filling in a couple of the elements that the Republicans in particular say are still missing, including something closer to a firsthand account of direct conversations with the president. Now, of course, Sondland has been accused of being less than truthful in some of his past testimony, mainly in defense of the president. And so whether they really get to the bottom of what this guy knows or they get halfway there, that's to be determined. I should say, by the way, Peter Welch, congressman from Vermont, is you were praising him, Colin, for being accessible to the Vermont media on this stuff. He is, in fact, going to be a guest on the Dave Graham Show here on Friday, I believe. So that'll be I think that'll be excellent because, you know, we'll just be coming off three straight days of testimony tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday in Washington, and then Peter Welch on Friday will be a guest on this program, and I think that's going to be a valuable interview, I think, on Friday. So I'm looking forward to that. And do you think that this actually, his performance in this so far, where he seems to have acquitted himself rather well, and actually asked that key question in the Mueller hearing this past summer about whether Robert Mueller expected more of this in the future? He said yes. Does this help Welch's career in Congress? Is he going to get some kind of a more plum role as the years come by?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that in this latest sort of, you know, since Speaker Nancy Pelosi has returned, to having the gavel there in the House, that his sort of stature among the Democratic caucus has risen, perhaps simply by the fact of being more veteran. But it certainly doesn't hurt for a politician to get huge amounts of national attention.
His future's so bright, he got to wear shades. All right, Colin, BT Digger, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Yeah, talk to you soon, Dave.
A little CBS News upcoming, a couple words from our sponsors, and we'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow.
We hear a lot about shopping local, and here in the Mad River Valley, we put our money where our mouths are. Make your holiday shopping a joyful adventure far from the press and stress of the big box stores. Come to the Mad River Valley and experience the joys and charms of a quintessential New England holiday. Stores, bars, and restaurants to fill a day trip, or take a few ski runs before heading into Warren or Waitsfield for lunch or a snack while checking off the items on your list. At the Warren store, you'll find something for everyone. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, where we're fun, funky, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back. Kevin Ellis is my next guest. Kevin is a longtime reporter for the Burlington Free Press. Maybe not that long. How long were you at the Free Press, Kevin?
3.5 years.
Yeah, that's
early 90s.
Early 90s, yeah. Did a nice job as the environmental writer for the Free Press back then. Then decided to make some money. Went into lobbying. And was a fixture at the State House for a while, and then his firm really took off and it got this national footprint going. That's since evolved in a different direction. Kevin, you're off on doing your own thing these days, including writing a regular blog and being an all-around political observer, I'd say from a Democratic liberal viewpoint. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Okay,
sure.
Yeah. I wanted to get that clear because we're going to ask you some questions here that might get under some of our listeners' skin a little bit because the conversation of this half hour, I think, is going to be mostly about what happened last week in the impeachment proceedings. What did you take away? What was your big takeaway or two or three takeaways from last week?
Takeaway one, long-standing State Department Foreign Service officers coming in, defying the president and telling the truth. Two, Republicans in Congress seeking to defend the president's behavior and not having much to work with. So throw up a lot of mud and dust and see if you can distract the public, which, to give them their due, I think they actually are fairly good at doing. And I think the question is, coming out of all this, is unlike, you know, you and I are old enough to remember Watergate. I was about 15. The question's going to be whether the public gives a darn.
Yeah, I think that is a key question. And what elements of the public give a darn? My sense of it, though, is that, an awful lot of Americans do care about the stuff they learned in school about separation of powers and all that sort of, you know, elementary, middle school civics class stuff that you got way back when. They care about respect for the presidency, and I think that there is some real concern about whether the current occupant of the White House has enough respect for the presidency himself. And I mean, a lot of people who defend the president and hear criticism say you don't have a sufficient respect for the presidency. And, you know, I really do think that there's a question about whether President Trump has understood from the time he took over the office, just what holding that same chair that was held by Washington and Lincoln and some pretty great people throughout our history, what that means. Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, I must say I lean a little bit deeper into the conspiracy than that. And that is, I worry that if you're under the age of 45, that those civics lessons that you just referenced, which I call, and I've written a lot about this, the sort of post-World War II world order that we helped create after the war with the Marshall Plan, et cetera, where the UN was created and NATO was created and all these institutions that have kept some semblance of order in the world. Trump is basically saying that is attacking that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder, you and I grew up with that world order and learned about it in school. If you're under 45 or 40, you didn't really, I'm not sure that kind of learning is taking place anymore. And therefore, the strength of that order and those institutions are susceptible to attack. And with internet and Fox News being the prime ways in which we can.
The point of the spear, yeah.
Point of the spear, right.
You know, I actually think this is really fascinating because what may have happened after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990, 91, that period in there, the Berlin Wall, of course, came down in 1989. And so all of that previous post-war order of these two polar opposites, really, of the Soviet Union versus the United States and essentially the rest of the world lining up in one of two parades, started to go away. And for a while, there were a lot of op-eds and editorials, et cetera, being written about how the United States was now, President Bush, George H.W. Bush talked about a, quote, new world order in which the United States was going to be sort of the one supreme power. Francis Fukuyama, of course, wrote his book, The End of History, talking about how you don't really have to worry about world conflict anymore because the conflict has been won. Boy, that didn't last, did it?
No, it sure didn't. And I guess I saw on the news this morning that Russia has now taken over the military base in Ukraine in Syria. That we abandoned.
Yeah.
And, 30 years ago, Dave, that would have been a absolute scandal. And now it kind of just goes under the radar.
Ho-hum.
Ho-hum. A couple of remarks on Twitter, and then you're out.
Yeah. Hey, we have a caller on the line, Rick from Adamant. How you doing, Rick?
Thanks. Hi, Kevin and Dave. To your point about civics and where we were at post-World War II, up until things have really changed, which the right and Republicans, I think, were really trying to find a way to gain back some control. They hadn't held Congress basically all that time.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of goes back to the Lewis Powell memo in 1971, generated by the Heritage Foundation and Lewis Powell. I think it's a good piece of history for people to know about. And they came up with the idea that they needed to first take over the media, take over the education system, do whatever they could to, bust unions and a few other things like that.
Yeah.
And with the election of Ronald Reagan, which I think was pretty suspect in how he pulled that off, they've been implementing that ever since, and that's what's really gotten us into this mess.
Interesting observation there, Rick. I think that certainly, it's a hard thing because, frankly, I come out of a long tradition in journalism of trying to be right down the middle and balanced and fair and all this great stuff. My long career with the Associated Press, that's still the standard, certainly for the AP and for many other traditional news outlets. And so it's a hard thing to say that to start talking about this sort of long-term strategy, or you know, to even talk about it in a slightly more negative spin, a plot really that got cooked up way back in the and one thing I noticed over time was that when you talk about taking over the media, for a long time in the 70s and 80s and 90s, there was this, I thought, a real concerted pattern of whenever a conservative columnist couldn't think of what to write about for the next column upcoming, you could always bash the quote-unquote liberal media.
Right.
And what the result of that has been really that the media have been cowed to a large extent. I mean, there hasn't been any real aggressive reporting against a conservative regime, I don't think, since Watergate.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly been the strategy to change the narrative. And that's what they've largely done. And even if it's a very centrist point of view, they try to paint it as some liberal left-wing point of view, and when it's really not. And so it shifted this country very far right.
One artifact of this, I've been doing a little research recently, trying to figure out, just comparing the criminal convictions of Republican administrations versus Democratic administrations over the past 50 years. I think 50 years is a pretty good sample size, really. You know, we're talking about almost a quarter of American history. So let's go back to 1969, and I believe the Nixon administration had something like 55 criminal convictions. The Reagan administration had 16. The Bush administration, I believe, had 16. Obama had, in his 8 years, one. That was David Petraeus pleading guilty to a misdemeanor about mishandling of classified information. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Carter had zero. So you add them all up, and it is more than 100 to less than 10.
Yeah.
And the reason most Americans don't know that is because the media have been bending over way backwards to be so balanced, unable to point something like that out.
Right. Yeah.
Kevin, what do you think?
Well, Dave, if I could make a cultural point.
Yeah.
The internet, we are just beginning to understand what the internet has wrought. Mm-hmm. And it's divided us into two camps, the Fox News camp and the MSNBC camp. I think those are a false equivalency myself, but we are now just going to the internet and going to TV and watching what already confirms what we already believe. That didn't exist when we were all watching Walter Cronkite. And I think we're just starting to come to grips with how that's changed the society.
You know, I think it actually goes beyond just the internet. I mean, and let's think about love for criminality for a moment, because two of the big heroes in the last 20 years of popular television have been Tony Soprano and Ray Donovan.
Yeah.
You know, and these guys are both just killers. They're vicious criminals.
Yeah.
And people love them.
Yeah.
So maybe it's okay to be a criminal. You know, maybe people say, that's fine, I'm voting for it.
Well, the President of the United States is that kind of guy. I mean, I've often said he's not incompetent and he's not stupid. He acts like a gangster. And Roy Cohn, Joe McCarthy's general counsel, was his hero. So that's how he's running this operation, is just like Tony Soprano. And if you listen to this Sondland, Ambassador Sondland, read the transcript, which we're going to hear about this week, and the way he was talking on his cell phone in a restaurant to the President of the United States, you're going to hear a lot of Tony Soprano style talking.
You know, actually, the mafia might want to look into some consulting here, because they could probably offer some tips on security of phone calls.
Trump made a memorable statement, I think it was in the campaign, where he talked about dealing with mafia guys in New York City real estate. And he said, I know these guys. I know how to deal with them.
Okay. Well, I feel like there's got to be some counterbalance here, because I think we're going way off the deep end here now into liberal conspiracy theory and stuff. Any callers out there want to call us up and tell us how badly we're going off the rails here? 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. 1-877-291-8255. And, you know, I'm looking for some way to say, There's some okay stuff going on here. I've heard some from some people on this very program about how they like what the president has done with the economy. There is a very interesting piece out. The online service MarketWatch did an analysis on the economy, talking about how the trends are really just a continuation of what was happening in the latter part of the Obama administration. In fact, I saw a chart where if those trends had continued, the economy on a key indicator, I'd have to dig up the chart again. But on one key indicator, I think just economic growth nationwide, it would have been slightly higher if the previous trends had just continued. And so when we hear all this chatter about everybody's great for the economy, and yeah, the new record Wall Street hit on Friday, so there is that. My retirement fund's been doing pretty well lately, so that's okay. But I just I'm just trying to. Well, let me see if Fred from Newbury can help. What about you, Fred?
Oh, as far as my question is, you know, what you talked about all these news medias and all the stuff that they're doing, that the country is so politically polarized and so politically corrupt. That, but we might have another civil war. I mean, it's crazy. I don't think, the Constitution is too powerful for another civil war. It's not going to happen, no matter how evil one party is to the other party.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I really have severe doubts about that as well. I hope that there is enough sort of civil structure left in society, including, frankly, if there were violence were breaking out in the streets, that you would have law enforcement put it down, essentially, and we can't have a civil war. That's just nuts.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but I don't think it'll even come to that.
I don't either.
I don't think. Yeah. Oh, good. Good.
Yeah.
I agree. How about that?
Okay. Hey, Fred, thanks for the call. I think we can agree on that we don't want a civil war.
But, David, Fred's on to something when he talks about the institutions that are – we were talking about this earlier. We don't value I think about my own kids. I think about a mid-level CEO, manufacturing CEO I know in New Jersey who is a pretty liberal guy. He said, I voted for Trump.
Yeah.
I said, why? He said, because I think the system's corrupt. I think the whole thing needs to be burnt to the ground and rebuilt. And, he's a highly educated, smart guy.
Do you think he's aware of this disparity in criminal convictions over the past 50 years between the two parties?
Probably not. And he knows that Trump is a...
not just Trump. Nixon had 55 criminal convictions connected with his administration.
Yeah. No, I don't.
Reagan
think
Reagan had 16.
No.
Remember Iran-Contra?
Right.
George W. Bush had 16. I mean, and so I think it really does bear pointing out that there's a difference here.
Yeah.
I mean, just by the numbers, I'm trying to be as objective as I can.
Yeah.
And when it's more than 100 to less than 10, that's not an even basketball game.
I'm going to go way out on a limb. Maybe it'll spur a lot of controversy and callers.
Yeah, please, let's do.
The reason that exists is because of I'm an older white male, okay?
Yeah, right.
It is the American white male that elected Trump and fears the disintegration of the society in which they grew up, the post-World War II, Mad Men generation, stable society, two cars in the driveway, home, mortgage, etc.
Yeah.
They feel that slipping away. And they will do anything to retain that culture, and including what's going on now.
Okay, does Jim from Barry get today's patience prize so far? Are you still there, Jim?
Yep, still here.
All right.
How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Not too bad. You made some comment about organized plans to try to shift the political landscape. And it reminded me of a very famous article that was written about 30 years ago about engineering a scheme or a blueprint to politically take over Vermont. And interestingly enough, the article was in Playboy magazine. I actually read it in a reprint. And the article.
Oh, come on. You got a copy of Playboy. No, I'm only kidding here. Go ahead.
Well, I may have actually, but But the reprint that I saw was a commentary on the article, and it used the term "Who moved the middle of the road?" That was the article, the second article about the first one.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was the one in Playboy. Supposedly, was not directly about Vermont. It was a hypothetical state that was very small towns that you could. And the whole focus was get into the local level, get involved in your school boards, get on the selectmen. They're real easy to get on because everyone thinks that everyone should do a stay on the select board.
Yep.
And when you get inside the machinery of a small town, you can then start to shift it. And this was touted in the second article as being a blueprint for how Vermont shifted to the left in the late 60s. Now, this article was probably around 1985 or something.
Yeah.
I moved here in 86, and I was reading the follow-up on it probably in 85, 86. Have any of you heard anything about that before?
I think I have, actually. That actually rings a bell, let's put it that way. And in fact, I think I remember the name Playboy in connection with that view of you know, last four or five decades of Vermont history. And frankly, I don't hear anything that is really that questionable there. I think either party wanting to move wanting to move the sort of political picture or atmosphere, that's the way you do it, is you start running for the school board, you start running for the select board, you start running for city council, whatever it is, and you work your way up through the legislature, and that's kind of the way politics gets done in America, I think, in the sort of traditional way. I think what we're talking about really is a much, much higher level decision to, just for one example, get rid of this thing that used to be called the Fairness Doctrine in national broadcasting, where, you know, it was expected, it was required, really, that both sides would get equal presentation in a broadcast. I still believe in that myself. That's why I urge, when I put an opinion out there, I urge people to call up and disagree with me, because I think that's how you get into a worthwhile conversation. But the Fairness Doctrine went away, and that gave birth to Rush Limbaugh and Fox News and a whole panoply of conservative media that basically, here's one example. This is coming into Vermont now. There was somebody who put up a post on a Vermont version of conservative media just this past weekend talking about Obama being very bad for press freedom. And I'm able to say that Obama was very bad for press freedom. He was terrible on that stuff. I don't have time to cite all the cases now, but that was one of the worst aspects of his presidency. And I'm happy to talk about that as somebody who's worked in journalism my whole career. I really care about it, and he was bad. And I don't mind mentioning that, even though I think a lot of people out there perceive me as probably more of an Obama supporter than, say, a Trump supporter. Okay, but one thing I never hear from the conservative media that they're just sort of sprouting up in Vermont these days is I've never heard any of them say that Trump is really, really bad in the following aspect. Have you, Kevin?
No. I've heard lukewarm complaints about, oh, I wouldn't have said that, and he shouldn't have said that, and that was...
But overall, he's great.
But overall, silence.
Yeah, silence, or he's great.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a big difference. But anyway,
And coming from my perspective, Dave, I agree with you 100%. Obama tried to put journalists in jail.
Yeah.
And he did put journalists in jail.
Bad news. Hey, we got to... I think we're coming up on the top of the hour here. Is that right, Dana?
In a few minutes.
Okay. Well, we got a little time left. Jim, are you still there?
No.
Nope. Okay. Jim's gone. And Kevin, I do think that this is worth really pointing out here, that there are conservative media outlets out there who almost never say anything critical of the conservative media and the conservative politicians. Whereas the New York Times, when Democrats go off the rails, they point it out.
Yeah, it's true.
Hey, I think that is about it for this half-hour segment. Now we got the correct cue here, I think. We're going to wrap this one up. But Kevin Ellis, thanks very much for coming.
My pleasure.
And let's go to some CBS News at the top of the hour. Mike Smith's going to be my next guest after 10.
Take the stress out of holiday shopping at the almost world-famous Warren Store. We have something for everyone on your list, from toys to beer, jewelry to wine, clothing to Yule logs. We have a wide selection of outerwear for men and women, all at 25% off from some of your favorite brands, such as Kool, Royal Robbins, Prana, Save the Duck, and more. Holiday cards, wrap, candles, pottery, snow globes, always friendly, knowledgeable customer service, and free gift wrapping. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli, then head upstairs to shopping heaven. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Thanks for staying with us. Our second hour here on this Monday morning, folks. Going to have a guest I'm excited about in just a few minutes. Mike Smith's going to be joining me. He's the secretary, the newly returned Secretary of Human Services for the state of Vermont. And one special aspect of Mike's career is he used to sit where I'm sitting right now. He was a host of the Dave Graham Show on WDEV for 2 or 3 years. We'll get these specific dates when Mike joins me in just a moment. But wanted to go first to Steve Futterman. He's with CBS News. We hear his voice a lot on the top of the hour and bottom of the hour news breaks here on WDEV, and it's really great to get to talk with him one-on-one. Steve, good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Great to be with you.
Hey, let me check in with you. I just wanted to kind of get a preview of coming distractions, or whatever you call that. The impeachment hearings resume tomorrow. They go Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday this week?
That's right. There will be 8 witnesses testifying this week, and I think they're going to be interesting witnesses. I thought last week had some interest as well, but these may actually be more interesting in the fact that some of these people may talk about more firsthand dealings they had with some of the issues involved. You may recall that one of the main things the Republicans tried to show was that many of these people did not have firsthand connections with any of the dealings. Many of these things were secondhand. And they brought that up quite a bit. We're going to have people closer to the top, I think, this week. And we'll see what happens. I mean, obviously, we know the tactics that are being used by both sides, and we'll see what they can do. Will there be anything new coming out? That's hard to say. Much of the information that we heard last week was things that had emerged before through either leaks or the transcripts that were released from the closed-door hearings.
And I think the one witness that has seemed to be generating a lot of headlines already is one of the upcoming witnesses, Gordon Sondland. He was on the phone with the president, we're told, from a restaurant in Kiev, correct?
That's right. Now, one thing that's interesting about him is that he's already, you're allowed to change your testimony at times. It may sound strange to you and me, but you are allowed to change your testimony. He has changed his testimony from the first time he appeared before the closed-door hearing. He adjusted his testimony to revise it, to say, well, on this issue I was wrong. And the thing that he was basically talking about that he adjusted for was, did you ever hear the president talk about a quid pro quo? Initially he said no, and then later on he seemed to indicate that he had heard a quid pro quo offered by the president. So that could be
maybe he just went and brushed up on his Latin. I don't know, but now I know what a quid pro quo is. I can, but he also didn't mention even in his second round the July 26th phone call from the restaurant, right?
Well, yes, but we did not even know about that till last week. So maybe he wasn't even questioned about that. So it'll be interesting to hear from him as well.
Well, I think he got a question about, you know, was there anything else you needed to tell us? Certainly. I mean, he got a pretty good invitation.
Sure.
Whether his not taking it as he might have is going to be open him up to any culpability. I don't know. We just have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to run a theory by you and see what you think about it. I've often wondered whether this idea of getting dirt on Joe Biden or Hunter Biden would be worth the, you know, basically risking your presidency over. I mean, that just strikes me as pretty small prize.
Back on it, of course, looking back on it, obviously not. I mean, different people view it different ways. There are people who think it's, I've heard Republicans who support the president say it's not such a big deal what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You're allowed, you know, it's all part of the gamesmanship of campaigning. The fact that you had a foreign country involved, though, and the fact that some people feel that that was what was being offered there, you're going to get the military aid, the military aid from the U.S. if you help us, that bothered lots of people. But, of course, looking back on it, probably not the best idea.
to do this. And
could the bigger prize?
A lot of problems.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I got to get this question in. Could the bigger prize really have been making Putin happy? Because imagine if you end up cutting off the military aid to Ukraine, that would fit right in this pattern of, you know, there's now a Russian flag flying over a former U.S. base in Syria. NATO has been greatly weakened from the very beginning of the Trump administration, just by his comments and his sort of, you know, very apparent lack of support. I mean, in so many ways, he's done things which might be seen as essentially pleasing Putin. And I'm wondering if this could have been part of that same pattern.
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, when you have dealings with Ukraine, yes, that can sometimes get involved. But I'm not sure that this was one of those things where he was talking about denying the military aid to please Putin. Obviously, Putin would be pleased if he didn't get the aid. Putin, you would think the way Putin operates, he does not want a strong Ukraine. He wants to control Ukraine. We sort of know that. But I'm not sure that I don't think that necessarily we've seen any indication that that was necessarily the driving point for this. Remember, Rudy Giuliani was talking about almost openly they wanted to get dirt on Biden. He was very, very open about it at some points.
Yep.
So I don't know if that was really what he was doing there. Many times what the president has done has been interpreted by his critics and even some of his supporters sometimes as that you're doing exactly what Putin wants, and it's not really in the U.S. interest, but it's in Putin's interest. Yes, if this did happen, if he denied Ukraine the aid, yes, it would be something Putin wanted, but I don't think we've ever heard anything to suggest that that was really the main reason he wanted to possibly not deny the aid. It did seem that he did want to get some dirt or continue the investigation on the man who at that time, and may continue to be his the biggest obstacle to win a re-election if he gets the nomination.
All right. Well, Steve Futterman of CBS News, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning. I think I've used up your promised time, so I'll let you go. But let's do this again.
Yeah, that sounds good. And the hearings to me are very fascinating. I'm old enough to remember the Watergate hearings as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think if you approach them in the right way, I think you can agree with the president, you can disagree with the president, but these are still very interesting hearings.
Well, actually, one last question on the hearings.
Yeah.
Do you know what times they start the next 3 days?
I believe they are going to start at, I'm not 100% sure, I believe they're going to start at 9 a.m. Eastern time.
9 a.m. Well, thanks for telling me because I'm actually trying to figure out the impact on my little radio program here, which usually goes from 9 to 11. So it's just a little bit logistical question to wrap it up with. But thanks again, Steve.
Yeah, the first day they started at 10, then they went to 9. I think it's at 9. Don't hold me to that, but that's my guess.
Okay, great. Thanks again. Nice chatting. My next guest, as I've already advertised a couple times on the program this morning, is Mike Smith. He is the newly returned, I guess is the best way to describe it, Secretary of Human Services for the state of Vermont. Governor Phil Scott appointed him to the job a month or so ago, and Mike tells me he's been on the job about 3 weeks now. And Mike, of course, a lot of our listeners will remember, was in this in the very seat where I am, I think, for a while. Mike, how long did you do the show here?
2.5 years.
2.5 years. Open mic, it was called. So, and he did a really incredible job with it, and it's great to have him back. I might have to get a couple of pointers and ask him when we're off the air in a few minutes. So, what do I need to improve, Mike? But instead, we won't talk about that on the air. Instead, we'll talk about this really important new job Mike has heading up the largest agency in state government. And Mike, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's an honor.
Well, David, it's a pleasure to be here, Dave. I really appreciate the opportunity. And Dana's board has changed a little bit.
Yeah, Dana got a new board. That's pretty sweet. He's got his new toys in there. I can't seem to wrangle new headphones in here, but we'll see if we can work that out at some point.
But the sardines are still here. Yeah. All sorts of things are here.
I frequently tell people I take no credit or blame for any of the interior decorating in this office because my 2 hours a day just come and go, and I really have not had time to paint the place or anything. So,
anyway, I don't think paint would hold.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. Anyway, Mike, you are. This is a second tour of duty as Human Services Secretary. You had the job under Governor Douglas back in the mid first part of the first decade of this millennium, right?
That's right. In 2005, I was originally the Secretary of Administration. Went over to Secretary of Human Services for a year, and then came back as Secretary of Administration. And it was, I'll say this, David, I mean, not many people get the opportunity that I have gotten, and I feel blessed in order to get this opportunity, and I thank Governor Scott for appointing me, because back then it was and still is to this day, one of the most rewarding experiences that I ever had is being Secretary of Human Services. And during that year that I was there, we did a lot of things. Global commitment, for example, some of the things that are still in place.
Yeah,
global commitment. We looked at Blueprint for Health. We did Vital that year. We did the Catamount Health. We did a lot of things that were very, very interesting. And I just feel privileged to be back.
That's great. Now, global commitment, of course, that was a healthcare item as well. Refresh us on what that was.
Basically, what happened is that the state, looking at its Medicaid program in how it was organized, was projecting an over $600 million deficit. Global commitment allowed us to get a little bit more cap space, what is called a cap, at the same time, allowed us flexibility in how we could spend it. And we, in doing that, we were able to eliminate the $620 million deficit.
I remember hearing some legislative testimony once about cap space, and I was thinking to myself, are we talking about an NBA payroll here or something? Or
it's as complicated as that. Believe me, it is complicated as that. It is really interesting that some of the issues that I'm dealing with now are the same issues that I was dealing with 14 years ago, including we're going to have to renegotiate this global commitment waiver, which has been negotiated one time before, but now it's coming up for renewal in 2021.
Wow. Okay. So that's going to be a big project. Tell me broadly, what else has changed about Vermont's human services posture in the last 14 years?
Let me. The tone has changed. I think two things. If I answer your question directly, two things. One. Well, actually, three things. The size of let me start with there. The size of the agency. I mean, it's 3,500 employees. That's relatively the same when I was here. The budget's bigger, $2.5 billion, has the same departments.
What was the budget previously?
You know, I can't remember, okay. I think it was like 1.7, maybe 1.8.
Has it grown kind of commensurate with inflation, or has it really exploded?
I think healthcare is really taken some of that growth into consideration. I want to talk about that in just a minute. So, you know, the agency has six departments, DALE, DCF, Department of Corrections, Mental Health, and then DIVA, which is the Medicaid portion of it, where there has been a lot of growth in that area. And if I had to say one thing that's changed, back 14 years ago, healthcare was probably 35, 40% of my time.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's probably 55 to 50% of my time, 55% of my time. Mm. So that has changed. The other thing, Dave, that I think has changed, just the sort of the atmosphere about government has changed in those times. That time period, the tone is different in that, and I'll get to my philosophy here in a minute, but the tone is that I see the tone shifting to government is the enemy.
Hmm.
And I don't believe that. I believe there is a proper role for government to intercede into people's lives to make their lives better or to protect people in the state of Vermont. And you know, that's why I thought this position originally was so rewarding. That's why I am so grateful to have this position again, because look, earlier in my life, I have been homeless. I haven't been out on the streets, but I didn't have a home. I've been broke. You know, in my younger year, my high school year, I would say I was rowdy. As you look at the various things that I used to do, I used to, you know, act out in dangerous and unproductive ways. But there was always a friend there to help me. To guide me, to take me under their wing and to help me get through those times. I view the agency just like that, just that friend for people that don't have the friends that I had and able to really help people. And I view the agency, all 3,500 of those people that are in the agency, as willing, have the same sort of mindset that I do, how to help people and move forward, how to be that friend and move forward. And the people that I've met, both then and now, they're dedicated to doing that. I think that is something that's really rewarding to me.
When you hear that the government is the enemy kind of stuff, do you feel like that there's any is that an echo or a trickle down from the famous comment that the scariest nine words in the English language are "I'm from the government and I'm here to help"?
That's a Ronald Reagan quote. The one thing that I don't think so. I think a lot of people, I think social media is part of it, that there is this sense that you can criticize anything and do anything. And, you know, part of our business, my old business, your business, is to evaluate various public policy programs, to do various things, to in some cases, criticize. But it's gone beyond a different level than I remember. I guess that's the tone change that I'm talking about. It's gone to a level, you know, where we're happy to have a nation full of criticizers, but not a nation full of doers. And I think, you know, I really respect the people that are out there doing things, the very hard things, like the people that work for the agency.
The DCF, the Department for Children and Families, came in for some criticism just a couple of weeks ago in a long piece in 7 days, for instance, about the opiate epidemic. And did you think that was fair?
You know, one of the things that I think we have to look, do we do things completely right? No. But do we do on a daily basis, is the preponderance of what we do good for Vermonters? And I think the answer to that is yes. For example, there was a death up in Chittenden County where a mother was allegedly murdered, and her two kids, an infant and a toddler, were in that apartment building for a couple of days before the woman was found. And it was our DCF workers that went in there, took care of those kids, made sure they had medical care, made sure that they were placed with a relative, and they spent the entire weekend, almost 24/7, making sure those kids were okay. Those are the stories that don't get into the news, but those are the stories that happen every day, and that's something that I think is things we lose focus on as we—
That is tough work. It's amazing how the time's flying. We got about 6 minutes left here, Mike. But and actually, we have a caller. We'll go quickly to Michael from Barrytown. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Dave. Good morning, Mike. It's been a while since I've talked with you.
Good morning, Michael.
I admit that I do not know enough to evaluate this current debate on health insurance. And the idea of Medicare for all, if structured so that literally everybody is protected for everything that they have to deal with, do you have an opinion as to whether that's the best way to go here? It seems like whatever we've tried has not worked well, and I can't compare apples for apples in any of this. I don't know enough.
Well, let me try to answer the question, perhaps without getting into the debate of Medicare for all, because I'm not as familiar with that debate as perhaps I should after 3 weeks. But
what, you've had 3 weeks?
Yeah, what's the matter?
Yeah. So I'll give you sort of a general philosophy. I think we have two choices in healthcare: do nothing or continue to watch healthcare costs climb uncontrolled, or at least do something and not worsen the condition, but do something to attempt to control healthcare costs. And when we talk about controlling healthcare costs, I think you really have to look at it holistically and how we receive care. We have to control healthcare costs. I don't care if it's Medicare for all or if it's private insurance. If we don't compare, if we don't control healthcare costs, then we're all sunk in terms of where we're going. So what does this mean when I say control healthcare costs? It means to me concentrating on primary care. It means preventive care. It means looking at the patient and treating a patient before they get sick with preventable diseases such as heart conditions, heart disease, diabetes. It means reimbursing a provider for those activities in a way that doesn't that concentrates on preventive medicine and doesn't reimburse them for how many tests that they do, how many procedures that they do.
So do you like the all-payer model?
You know, it's still an experiment. I think there's been some Medicaid budgeting that has made it predictable because of, I like to call it the all, you know, I don't like all-payer. I like to call it the accountable care model.
Okay, same idea. I mean, words to describe the same thing.
But all-payer, it just goes over people's head.
Okay,
accountable means that it is, that somebody is looking at it accountable. So has it made Medicaid budgeting more predictable? Yes. Has it made more providers that are joining? Yes. However, OneCare, for example, needs to put more accountability into the system, and they need to tell people what they're doing in order to do that. So that's a short answer to a long question.
Yeah, boy. And I'll tell you, this is why we're going to have you back, Mike Smith, if you're willing, at a later date to talk about a lot more of this stuff, because so much going on in human services. Just quickly in the last couple of minutes here, your thoughts on the justice reinvestment efforts, the correction system really trying to cut the number of inmates, and do we need to do more of that?
I think so, and I think there's a couple of things that we need to do. We need to look at our correctional facilities. This was 14 years ago, Dave. Our correctional facilities, from an infrastructure perspective, were pretty
rough shape.
They're still the same now. We have to address how we're going to move corrections in the future, bring people home, and house those people.
I would think in 14 years they'd be in rougher shape, because
they are.
I bet you. I mean, that population, frankly, is going to give a building a beating, don't you think?
I do. I've been to Northwestern. I've been to Newport. I plan on visiting all our correctional facilities and get a better evaluation and better knowledge of what's going on.
I thought you were
going
to say the biggest change in your between 2005 and now is the impact of the opiate epidemic. But I wonder, do you think we're getting a handle on that?
You know, I think we're starting to. Look, it was starting back 14 years ago, and we started the Deter program, for example, and those sort of things. Heroin was rampant in the state, and we were trying to address it. Opioids, in a broader sense, now have had an impact on this state. I think the hub and spoke and what we've done in that and try to treatment, you know, it's a systematic attack that we have to do, from education to rehabilitation to enforcement, as we move forward.
There's so much on your plate, Mike Smith. I remember talking with Al Gobay once, your predecessor, and he was maybe having a rough day or something, but he just looked like he was really, it was a struggle. And I think that it's, man, what a job, and I admire anybody who's willing to take it on. Thank you so much for coming in, Mike Smith, new and old Secretary of Human Services, and we'll have you back. Unfortunately, we're about out of time for now, but thanks a million.
Thank you.
And we will be back after some bottom of the hour CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors, and we're going to have some open phone lines, I think, in the last half hour, and we will go from there. We'll be back.
We hear a a lot about shopping local, and here in the Mad River Valley, we put our money where our mouths are. Make your holiday shopping a joyful adventure far from the press and stress of the big box stores. Come to the Mad River Valley and experience the joys and charms of a quintessential New England holiday. Stores, bars, and restaurants to fill a day trip, or take a few ski runs before heading into Warren or Waitsfield for lunch or a snack while checking off the items on your list. At the Warren store, you'll find something for everyone. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, where we're fun, funky, and friendly. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Alrighty, folks. Hey, we just got the official word from CBS News about their plans, their coverage plans for this week. And it looks like tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday, the 3 days of the impeachment hearings upcoming, going to be really riveting stuff, I think, especially when Gordon Sondland is testifying about his phone call from the restaurant in Kyiv to President Trump, and several other really interesting witnesses upcoming as well. And some of them, including Mr. Sondland, he, of course, is the ambassador to the European Union who got himself involved in some of the Ukraine dealings earlier this year. And we'll have some important stuff, I think, to say, providing he's truthful and so on. Anyway, these hearings are going to be broadcast live via CBS on WDEV next 3 days, all 3 days, starting at 9 a.m. And let's see, CBS is talking about them going into the afternoon in each occasion. I think that means, it looks like that means that the Dave Graham Show is going to take a break, but that's okay. I got to get a painting project done at home, so we will maybe get some of that done this week. And one moment. Pardon me. We continue into our final hour of the program this morning. I wanted to get folks to weigh in here about what they heard last week from Mr. Taylor, Mr. Kent on Wednesday. Two State Department officials, William Taylor, now the current sort of acting ambassador in Ukraine. I think his official title is charge d'affaires or something like that, which basically means he's in charge of affairs. They sometimes throw some French at you in that diplomatic corps. But Mr. Taylor was testifying along with George Kent, another State Department official, on Wednesday. Friday, very interesting stuff with Marie Ivanovich, the former ambassador to to Kyiv, to Ukraine, and she was ousted from that job back in May. She says after a sort of a smear campaign launched against her and carried out by Rudy Giuliani, the President Trump's personal lawyer, and she was a very compelling witness, I thought, on Friday. I mean, I was watching the hearings, and boy, it struck me that the Democrats, the sort of prosecution here in the House, could not have asked for a better witness. She was poised and careful, and was on the moments when she seemed to be invited or had an opportunity to just kind of go out on a limb and perhaps say some things which were more speculative or more critical, she resisted. She was just the facts, ma'am, and it was quite an impressive performance by Marie Ivanovich. And as I mentioned, the hearings resume tomorrow, 9 o'clock each day, on broadcasting live here on WDEV. And I'm curious to know, we got about 20 minutes to go here on the Dave Graham Show, and I want to open the phone lines and ask you listeners out there to tell me what you make of what happened last week, what you expect to hear this week. And the phone number here in Waterbury, 244-1777. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. Is this whole thing a sham? Do you think it's just basically a Democratic performance, play acting here, trying to gin up outrage where none is deserved, etc., toward this president? Obviously, he's not been the favorite of most Democrats in Congress or at large in the country in the last 3 years that he's been in office. And so maybe that's the best way to view the thing, that this is just somebody saw an opportunity to launch what they hoped would be the final and fatal attack against this presidency. And that's certainly something we hear from a lot of commentators in the more conservative media out there. And so I'm curious to know what folks think about all of this. Once again, 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. Meanwhile, you know, it's interesting when something like impeachment hearings are going on, how the news becomes dominated by this one sort of narrative. But other stuff has been happening, and other, you know, some media, there are some reporters who aren't assigned to cover these hearings. They got to figure out something else to do. And one thing an outfit called Market Watch did, they actually went and looked at some of the economic indicators. I mentioned this briefly back around the top of the hour, I think, but I think it bears looking at a little more carefully. And the Market Watch piece essentially was talking about looking at the performance of the economy since President Trump came into office. He has talked many, many times about how it is the strongest economy ever, and it's a truly remarkable thing that he's been able to do with the economy. A lot of President Trump supporters are buying that, and they're really calling this his strong suit, et cetera. And they think that the trade disputes with China are going to end up being a good thing for the U.S. economy, and trying to reverse some trends in our trade situation, our foreign trade situation. The Market Watch, which is an online publication, looks at the economy at the markets. I think you would understand from its name. Has been doing some analysis on economic conditions. And now one thing you got to say is that the stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial, hit a new record high on Friday. It surpassed the 28,000 mark. That's a very, very strong performance. And if that is the sole measure of the economic performance in the United States of America, you've got to say, boy, things are booming. And but then there are other issues in the economy as well. For instance, how are we doing on providing jobs for folks? And I'm looking at a very interesting chart in Market Watch. The job performance here, this chart indicates, is following the trend that was in place in the mid-teens of this decade. And of course, we had a different president up through 2016, and according to this Market Watch chart, there's a line here for reported number of jobs in millions and number of jobs if the previous trend had continued. The previous trend, of course, being the one that existed up through 2016, and the line for the previous trend continuing is actually slightly higher, just a bit higher. Not remarkably so, but then the line for actual job performance since 2016, job growth performance, I should say. And so that to me is quite interesting. It says that this has not really been a giant transformation of our economy as some people have tried to paint it, including, I think it's fair to say, the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. And, I think that you've got to measure that also against federal spending and the efforts to stimulate the economy that the president has put in place. The big tax cuts at the end of 2017 were, it was said, designed to stimulate job growth in the country. It looks like we could have done without them, frankly, and the country would have been just about where it is in terms of actually a little better in terms of job growth. So I don't know. I think that there's some reasonable skepticism there. I have another area where I want to explore a little bit, but I'm going to take a phone call here from Rama first. Rama from Williamstown, good morning.
Yeah, hey, good morning. If I had $1 trillion that I could just borrow and throw out into my economy, I'd look like a trillionaire, wouldn't I?
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because that's exactly the point I wanted to get to next, is that normally, you know, in the old style Keynesian economics, the government spends a lot of money when the economy is doing poorly. I've mentioned this on the show previously. Yep. I'm sure you've heard it.
Yep.
And here the government, the chief spokesman to the government, the president of the United States, is telling us the economy is booming more than it ever has before in American history. So why do you need $1 trillion worth of stimulus?
Well, he lies anyway. That's all. I mean, basically, that's what he does is is lie. So, you know, it's what it is. It's something that people, I think, are finally coming to an understanding, and I would look forward to him actually having some courage in his life for a change and showing up in front of the House committee for the impeachment hearing so he can be questioned under oath.
The one who started it all, you mean?
Well, he's not the one that started it all. Remember, this started decades ago, and this is really the point I wanted to get to.
Well, I was making a semi-humorous, I hoped, reference to Peter Welch's comments last week. Actually, the first Jim Jordan's reference, but go ahead.
I'm not interested in their cutesy little comments.
Your point about decades ago.
But, you know, listen, this all started decades ago, but what I really called up about was a bit about the press that you had been talking about earlier, and how the press started doing different coverage over the decades, and it started trying to put in this phony, you know, we got to give both sides equal airtime, and how it didn't really work out that way. And there seems to be this constant push by people from the press. And, you know, listen, this isn't personal, but I do think you're one of the people to blame for it, along with many others, who act like the national and local press has never had a position that it's taken on issues throughout the history of this country. And if you go back to probably a person who could be called one of the granddaddies of modern day newspapers, Benjamin Franklin used to actually write letters to his own paper under a pseudonym just so he could go after his political enemies without putting his own name to it. And the press has not gotten any better about this since then. And even in the news coverage, and if there's been one major failing, or no, not one, there's been multiple major failings in the press, but if the biggest one is probably the lack of trying to provide any historical context for what gets reported on in any given day, and it leads to this attitude that, oh, this is what's happening today, and nobody's thinking about, well, how did we get to the point where this is happening today? And when you try to have that discussion, the press is absolutely incapable of getting into that discussion because they want to keep, well, this is what this person said, this is what another person said, but there's a history behind our politics of today. Trump, the Republican Party is not the Trump Party. It's the Republican Party. Trump is part of this Republican Party and what they've been building up over decades of time, period. And by the way, I'll say the same for the Democrats because they've been such a bunch of weaklings. I call them surrender monkeys that, you know, they've helped get us to the point where we're at, too. And people have to understand this is what's so important about these impeachment hearings, in that over the last half a decade where we've seen an extreme amount of power get shifted over to the executive branch of our government, we need a legislative branch. And frankly, I don't care if it's against a president I like or for a president or against a president I don't like. We need a Congress that will reassert itself because historically they've given up so much power. We have seen a suffering because of this. And when people look around and say Obama was acting like a dictator, well, you mentioned in your press he was trying to shut down leakers big time. So yeah, Obama did have his bad sides, and we never got to address it because the Democrats. And now finally we have somebody that has pushed it to such an extreme, maybe we can address, you know, protecting, understanding that our government's for ourselves. But anyway, the main point I want to make is just this historical context. One caller called in about the Powell memo. You know, having these historical contexts and presented regularly in light of today's events is extremely important.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I think it's important to look at the statistics related to criminal convictions by administration over the past 50 years. This is what I've been talking about a couple times on the show recently. And, I think, because I have a very good friend who said to me repeatedly over the last couple of years, oh, you know, both sides do it. They're equally corrupt. And if you look at criminal convictions, and again, I chose that category, not indictments, not charges made by people, but this is an independent judiciary. Either the person pleading guilty and admitting they did something wrong, or an independent judiciary, the courts determining that they've done something wrong. And it's more than 100 to fewer than 10.
And you can look at the economies. I mean, I don't care how you want to measure it. You can look at any part of the economy, whether it's national deficit, national debt, Wall Street returns. You know, there's a whole long list of items that get better under Democratic administrations as opposed to Republican ones. And it never, you know, but the what people have to do, the problem is the historical context has to be repeated as often as the events of today do. Because otherwise people just lose sight of it. And what you're saying, as true as it is, but unless it's repeated every time that that somebody gets out and says, oh, the Democrats are just as corrupt as the Republicans, unless something like that is actually repeated, people don't understand that, you know, listen, the truth is very obvious, you know, and it's opposite from the statement that everybody does it.
Here's one last point before we do need to go to a break very shortly, but you know, I just want to say again that the one of the issues here is that the press get beat up all the time, particularly from the right. I mean, if you turn on Fox News, which is, you know, a very heavily watched cable news network out there, you constantly hear that it's the left-wing media that are destroying the country or the enemies of the American people, just as the president says, and so on and so forth. And so there's this constant drumbeat that as a working reporter for more than 30 years, I heard all the time. And one analogy or metaphor I would use would be to say, if you're driving down a road and you're the person in the front passenger seat, let's say your spouse, is harping on you all the time about driving too close to the center line, you're going to tend to drive to the right. You know, you're going to start heading over toward the shoulder just to keep the peace, and just because, you know, you're getting this constant drumbeat of criticism about hewing too much to the center. And there really did seem to be this concerted strategy to talk about how the press were way too liberal. And all during this era when this is happening, you know, there was one person in the national media who had a regular seat on the This Week show on ABC, who had a regular weekly column in Newsweek magazine, and who was the lead op-ed writer for the Washington Post. His name was George Will. And you know, a major, major player in setting the opinion climate of this country. Has George Will been mostly a liberal or mostly a conservative, would you say?
Well, obviously he would consider himself a conservative. My final comment on that is, you know, because the descriptions you're using is part of the problem, this left, this middle, this right, and it really doesn't hold up. And people understand this. And by the way, the press is made up of adults, and you guys, if in the press, if you can't stand the heat, you know, just like I'd say to other people, get out of the kitchen. But it's a matter of getting out there and telling people what's going on, and over and staying true to your mission and not worrying about who's going to be calling you the latest name.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, and I would say that for the most part, I've tried to withstand that criticism, but I'm sure that the atmosphere full of it just has to seep in occasionally. Anyway, Rama, I got to go, but I appreciate the call, and let's go to Dave from Plainfield. What do you think, Dave?
First of all, I wanted to tell you, my family is from Ukraine, and I still have family that lives in Krakow and family that lives in northern Iran, and I've been on the radio for 35 years. Greg Hooker knows me at Greg's old station. And I wanted to ask you, I just turned on the radio. So you've been there for 30 years. I ask everybody these questions. How many times have you said the name Barry Satorio in the 30 years that you've been on the radio?
Well, first a correction. I haven't been on the radio for 30 years. I worked for 30 years, more than 30 years, for the Associated Press Bureau in Montpelier, mainly a printout. We did write some broadcast copy, but it was mainly, the work that went out under my byline and so on was all for print consumption. So there's that. I've been on the radio as a regular host of this show since March, or late February, I guess it was, of 2018. So almost 2 years now. It'll be my second anniversary upcoming in a couple months. but so let's go to your question again, though. I didn't catch the name you were asking
Barry Satoro. I go around asking. I've done radio for 35 years. I'm the first person in my family. You understand, my family's immigrants, so we don't understand your country.
Now, come on.
We know. My family doesn't. My family, I'm Iranian, Kurds, Roma, and they lived in Ukraine. See, people get confused about Ukraine. I was told all my life I was a Ukrainian, and no, it's a big place like California, and my family wandered into Ukraine from northern Iran, and my oldest son, by some miracle, actually found it. I don't know why the hell. So that's what I'm saying. Ukraine is a very complex issue, and I've never heard anybody study it, so I could come and do whole lectures on Ukraine. But anyway, I just go around asking. I'm in a hurry.
Okay. My answer to your question is I don't know this name. I don't think I've ever mentioned it. Therefore.
Okay. Well, this is okay. Well, this is. By the way, Greg will tell you, I'm the guy, I go on the radio, I've done shows here for years, Dave, and I've told people the Alan Green, I used to caddy at a golf course when I was a kid, and I caddied for Alan Greenspan, and all these, I tell these Greenspan stories and all these things. And
hey, Dave, you know what I hate to do? I hate to tell you, but the we get coming up on the top of the hour here. I wish you'd called a little earlier, but I got to wrap it up because we are in our last 30 seconds here, and I want to tell folks that... tune in tomorrow for the impeachment hearings. Dave Graham Show, I think we'll be back on Friday. And have a great day, everybody.